Hey Who fans, and welcome to the Big Blue Box Podcast. My name's Gary.
My name's Adam.
And welcome to episode 194.
Yes. Have you ever thought what it's like to be wanderers in the fourth dimension?
Nobody in the universe can do what we're doing.
I've reversed the polarity of the neutron flow, so the TARDIS should be free of the force field now.
There's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish sometimes.
The trouble with time travel is, one never seems to find the time.
Change, my dear. It seems on a moment too soon.
Unlimited rice pudding, etc., etc.
I am the Doctor!
Great men are forged in fire. It is the privilege of lesser men to light the flame.
I'm the Doctor. This is Rose Tyler. She's my plus one. Is that all right?
That would be me.
Hello. Surprise!
Boom!
Etc. I'm the Doctor. Do everything I tell you. Don't ask stupid questions. And don't wander off.
How can new kidneys? I don't like the colour.
Howdy do, Who fans. Welcome to 194. Hope you're all well and you've had a cracking week and that you've managed to do something.
Doctor Who related. Oh, yes.
Maybe you've peeled yourself away from football. Maybe.
Maybe.
It's England game tonight.
Is it?
As far as I know.
Oh.
Yep.
Yeah, we're not footy fans, are we? I haven't got a clue. I'm speaking for both of us, but I haven't got a clue. I know what a football looks like.
Yeah, it's that round thing, isn't it?
It's that square thing with the blocks. Yeah.
I used to be into football many moons ago.
Mm.
Many moons ago when I was younger, sort of in high school. And for a little bit after that, but sort of got bored with it a little bit, really. Haven't really been into anything since. But I do watch the England World Cup games when they're on, because they're a good laugh.
Yeah, a good laugh. Yeah. No, I haven't got a clue what's going on. I only watch it if Doctor Who's going to be premiering some trainer in the middle of it. That's the only reason I tune in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, how have you been, buddy? What have you been up to?
I'm great. Yeah, I'm great. It's absolutely frying here in the UK. I've actually lined up, this is true, I don't even see it. I've actually got 3 pint glasses of water next to me as we record today, because I'm as dry as a bone over here. Yeah, absolutely frying, but it's gorgeous, it's gorgeous. I've had another cracking weekend, Doctor Who related as well. So last weekend we were at the BFI mingling with some Doctor Who guys, and that was brilliant. This week I shot across London to do 2 conventions. Went to one in Chiswick, the Phantom one, which we've been to a few times. I was only there really briefly. So I literally went in, I grabbed my free print that comes with the ticket price, because I bought my tickets ages ago. But to be fair, they didn't really announce many guests that I was that excited about. So I was a bit like, but I thought I'll go and get my print. Go and see what's happening. Grab a couple of badges, because they've always got some cool Doctor Who badges. Get out of there. So I got there, and the only person I met, they had Philip Hinchcliffe was there, but I've met him before. He seemed to be having a good time. John Levine was there, but again, I've met him many a time, so I didn't bother with him. But I did meet Roger Murray Leach, who is a production designer Doctor Who, but he had some really nice Blake 7 prints of the Liberator, like the sort of blueprint of it. Okay. That he was signing for charity. So I got one of them. Actually, sorry, my friend Will actually bought one for me, which is really nice of him. So I met Roger, got a quick pic with him. He said he loved my R2-D2 phone case, which was cool. and then I was out of there, and I shot across town to Westminster, where Tom Baker was doing a signing. And most of the people that I was supposed to be meeting at Phantom, once Tom had been announced for Westminster, decided they were going to ditch Phantom and go to that event. So most of the people I was meeting were all at Westminster.
Right.
So getting there, I managed to get there in time for the photo shoot. I didn't intend to get Tom's auto, because I knew his queue would be massive. And sure enough, it was. It was, you know, they were doing virtual queuing, and it was just all day. The man was just signing. It was unbelievable. Got my photo shoot with Tom. Managed to get there exactly when I needed to get there, which was good. Usual thing where there's this ongoing thing, isn't there, with me about I've got a few photo shoots of Tom and he's always been really nice when I've met him, but whenever they take that picture, I've just never caught him smiling, have they? It's become a bit of a running joke, isn't it? My last one with him, he looks really subdued. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yet, like 2 seconds before, he was beaming with laughter. So I've always said to you, like, oh, I never managed to get a smiley pic with Tom. Well, it's finally happened. I've finally got possibly the... I couldn't ask for a better picture, could I? I mean, you
looks great.
Used to,
yeah.
I was, you can imagine, mate, because the picture's taken. At one point, he was looking at me rather than the camera when she was trying to take it. And I was like in my head thinking, please look round, Tom. Please look round. I don't want you looking at it. And he did. And so I had no idea what the expression was going to be like. So I'm waiting for it to pop out of their little photo machine because they give it to you straight away at that event. You know, they sort of literally print it off 2 seconds after you had it. So I'm waiting for it to come out thinking, oh, what's it going to be like? And I was so relieved when I saw it. It's a really cracking picture. And then I did actually, because... the queue had died down quite a bit, but because I was there so late, I did actually queue up to meet Tom and get his autograph and stuff and had a nice little chat with him. A lot of people said he looked like he'd lost weight. He does.
He definitely
looks a bit, he did look a bit thinner. When I first saw him, I was sort of struck by his, you know, the change in appearance. One thing I would say though is, he really seemed in good spirits. Like he did look a bit frail, but he actually wasn't at all. I mean, when he came out at the end of the day, he came out, so, you know, when he left, mm-hmm. he walked out and he was with another guy and he was chatting. And a few people actually went up and got selfies with him and stuff. And he was in really great spirits. And the man had been signing all day. In fact, he signed longer than he was supposed to. I think he was supposed to leave at 4. And he was just so engaging with people as well. He just didn't seem to be fazed at all. So yeah, he's in very good spirits, is Mr. Baker. So that was good to see. The only other person I met that day was Louise Jameson, who played Leela. And I had a lovely little chat with her. We're talking about conventions, actually, because we were sort of just saying, you know, are you having a nice day? Are you enjoying it? She goes, yes, I'm enjoying this one. I don't always. And we were like, oh. So we had a nice little chat about that. She was just saying she prefers it. She likes it when it's a smaller convention and, you know, it's not so busy and rushed and stuff.
Okay, cool.
And I made an absolute clanger because I said to her, because, you know, you're trying to think of things to say once you actually get into a proper conversation, because there's, you know, no one around. Something. I was just like, oh, yeah. I said, well, she said, I've met you before. I said, yes, you have. I was thinking, oh, she remembers me. I said, once seen, never forgotten. And I said, yes, I've seen you a few times. So I come to see you in a play, actually. And she's like, which one? And I just couldn't think. I was like, which one was it?
Oh, no.
I said, oh, it was The Frightened Lady. And she's like, no, wasn't it? I've never done that. I was like, oh, no.
Oh,
she's like, was it The Mousetrap? I was like, yes, it was The Mousetrap. I said, she goes, oh, that was Rula Lenska that did The Frightened Lady. I was like, oh, yeah. So completely mixing the two up. I'm like, oh, no. Could feel the lead. You know, I knew what the lever to just let myself drop through the floor. But she was lovely. I had a really good little chat with her. So it was good. And then inevitably, as soon as the convention's over, I could wait to get to the pub and just chill out, because it had been quite a stressful day, to be fair. Sort of I'd had massive train delays. I got to Chiswick really late and, you know, dashed across to Westminster, and it was so busy, the Tom event. It was just crazy, the amount of people in that little Westminster hall. So I was gasping to get out of the hall and into the pub, and just like we did at the BFI, very much the same group of people, actually. We all went to the pub and got... we did get smashed, actually, because I had a few drinks, talked about all our Doctor Who stuff that we'd got in the day. And yeah, just another cracking weekend. I said to someone there, I actually love the meetups as much, if not more, than the convention. Like, mm-hmm. I just couldn't wait to actually go and socialize with people. I wasn't, you know, I just get out of the event and do that. So yeah, it was a really good day. So I was happy. Happy chap.
That sounds awesome, mate.
It was good.
Another good one. Yeah.
Yeah. No, there's two weekends on the road that have just absolutely smashed it, you know. Yeah.
I think it's quite quiet now, isn't it, until the big one?
Till AFCC. Yeah, well, this is it, isn't it? Because it's a bit like you sort of get home and then you're just like, oh, I've had such a good day. Mm-hmm. And then you're on a bit of a sort of, it's hard to come down from it. Like, it took me ages to get to sleep. I was just sort of on a real high. And I kept thinking, when's the next one? Like, when am I next going to see those guys? You know, because it's not so, as I said, it's not so much as the events. It's just meeting up with the group of people, and, you know, and yeah, I think the next one will be London Film Comic Con, which is the end of July, isn't it? So
the end of the month, yeah.
I don't think there's anything in between that.
I don't think so.
Yeah, because you're going. I've bought my ticket for the Sunday. You're going Saturday and Sunday, aren't you?
Yes.
Yes. I'm hoping to join you on the Saturday. I'm just waiting for. It's just money, really. I thought I'd better get my ticket for the Sunday, so at least I know I'm there at least one day. But yeah, hopefully I'll be there too, same as you. Yeah.
I need to book my photo sessions. Still.
It's just. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Still after. I'm still. Yeah. I don't know why I'm holding back. You know, it's you and I like this. We just
I'm the same, mate. Yeah. I know, but it's the prices. That's why I'm holding back. I keep looking at the people I really want, and they're like Eccleston and Capaldi, and I'm like, well, that's 160 quid right there for those two. I can't afford it.
Yeah,
it's too much. So every time I go to book my photos, I'm like, nah, you know, just holding off. And then I'm thinking, okay, there's a couple of cheaper ones like Ingrid Oliver. I really want, so that's a definite. So I'm the same as you, mate. I keep hovering over it thinking I'm going to book them, but it's just that as soon as I start to add them to the basket, you're looking at like 200 or 300 quid.
Yes.
You know, it's for like 40, you're getting 4 or 5 people for that.
It's big bucks.
It's yeah.
Yep. So a lot of money in it. Yeah. And yeah, because I keep flitting between, you know, do I want one or two sort of, what's the term? Not more well-known celebrities, but you know, higher profile, I suppose, A-listers. I don't know how to describe it, but you know, I keep flitting between, do I want sort of Capaldi and someone else, or do I want sort of the, and I hate sort of putting people in buckets, but you know, do I want sort of the lower priced people? So I think I'm definitely going to get Noel Clarke and Ingrid Oliver.
Yeah. Yes.
But when I do that, I sort of put those in because they've changed the classic Doctor's photo shoot as well because McCoy's cancelled.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
yeah.
So I think now they've changed it. It's now Colin Baker, Paul McGann, and David Bradley.
Well, that's a pretty good shoot, actually.
In front of the TARDIS, yeah. So that's quite tempting, but that's like 80 quid.
Yeah.
So if you do that in Capaldi, like you said, you know, that's 150, 160 quid. And that's before you've set foot in a building. That's before you've bought anything at the stalls, bought lunch and all that lot. So
yeah, lunch is probably about 20 quid just for a mouldy old hot dog.
Half
hot dog and a warm Coke.
Yeah. So it's not cheap to do. I mean, to be fair, some of the smaller conventions that we go to, like the Chiswick one and Westminster, they're not too bad. You know, it's normally fairly reasonable. But the big ones, like the MCMs and London Film Comic Con, it's big monies. So, yeah. But we'll definitely be there. It'll just depend on who we get photos with and so on.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why I booked the Sunday, mate. So at least I know I'm going to be there a day. Mm-hmm. But it's again, it was like when I put the two in the basket, I was like, so it's 20 quid for the Sunday or 21 quid, whatever. And then it's 22 or 23 for the Saturday. So I was thinking, well, there's 45 quid for 2 days. So I just thought I can't do it this month. I'm just going to have to buy one day. And then next month, and you know, trying to afford the other day, it adds up so quickly.
Oh, it does.
But again, I'm so looking forward to it because that'll be the next big meetup. Yeah.
Other than that, I don't know about you. I've not really done anything. The only thing I've done really is sort of gush and drool over the season 12 Blu-ray sets that we got through finally from Amazon. It was quite annoying that there's a bunch of people that. Ordered from zoom.co.uk and they got theirs last week.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
So I'm not sure what the delay was, but with Amazon. But I know that you found a problem which we thought was rectified on one of the discs.
Yes, I've been trying to find out a bit more information about this. And what are they called now? It's not BBC Enterprise anymore, is it? It's
BBC
not BBC
Studios?
Worldwide. BBC Studios have been a bit quiet. So basically, just first of all, just like you said, the sets arrived. Mine arrived yesterday. I was quite surprised actually because Amazon could be a bit slow. It's a beautiful set. So this is the the Fourth Doctor season 12 Blu-ray. Absolutely, the pack it totally worth the wait. I mean, it's beautiful, isn't it? It's just one of those things that when you take it out of the box, it's just really something nice to have in your collection. It all folds out and. You know, this is the limited edition packaging, so I don't know what the standard one will be like. But yeah, sadly, it seems like, and this is the thing, I don't know if it's on every set or if it's just on a certain batch or whatever, because a lot of people have noticed that the sound on episode 1 of the Sontaran experiment it is faulty. The left channel is slightly out of sync, and it's only playing through sort of like the back speaker sort of thing. So it gives a very tinny sound effect. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, mate, because you're quite technical. Isn't this exactly what happened with the blimmin' Day of the Doctor Blu-ray?
Yep.
I mean, it's history repeating itself again with the BBC. I don't know why it's so difficult to get these things right and not check them before they're actually. But the thing I'm confused about is because I thought they'd already picked up on this, and I thought that was the reason that it got delayed by a week or two recently so they could rectify it. So it just makes you think, so does that mean, is it a certain batch that have got this problem, or is it just that they didn't correct it and they've sent them out anyway? And if that is the case, are they going to, you know, offer a replacement disc? So at the minute, we don't know, because a lot of people have picked up on it, and a lot of people have emailed. There's an email address, which I'm afraid I don't have to hand, but you can easily find it.
It's DVD. It's DVD inquiry line at bbc.com.
That's it. So you can email them about it. And I don't think anyone's had a response yet, because I keep sort of checking on this to see if anyone knows what the situation is. I must admit, I don't know about you, mate, because obviously last night I was watching Dragonfire for our review. And so I couldn't take over the television the whole night. So unfortunately, I haven't really got a chance to really dive into my box set yet, because we're recording on a Tuesday this week, which is unusual for us. We're normally a Wednesday, so we're right at the start of the week. I've only had it a day, and so I haven't really had a chance to sort of get my teeth into the box set yet. I don't know about you.
Exactly, the same, mate. No, not had a chance yet.
Yeah. No, I know we've seen a few snippets of the extras at the BFI event and stuff, so I'm really looking forward to getting into it, but I haven't had a chance to even check mine yet. But it's from what I understand, it seems that most people, or at least everybody I've spoken to, has got the same issue. So I'm guessing it's all of them, but it might not be.
I don't know. Yeah. So there's actually two faults with the box set.
Oh, is there? Or what's the other one?
So the first one you mentioned, the audio problem on the Centauran experiment. The second one is not an audio problem, it's a visual problem. So, and this is for Revenge of the Cybermen. On part one, Michael Wisher is a typo. So they've misspelled his name.
What?
So is Michael Wire, or Michael, his name is spelled W-I-A-H-E-R instead of Wisher. So they've messed up the credit on there. And also at the very end, the very sort of the penultimate shot doesn't transition properly into the final shot. So instead of this nice transition, there's like a frame problem where it sort of stutters. It's like this flickering effect where they haven't quite got the transition correct between the last two shots of the story.
It's not
great, but there is that DVD inquiry line email address, and like you say, no one's had anything back from the Beeb yet.
No, I was just having a look on the merchandise site that we go to a lot, which is brilliant. And, you know, just looking down the sort of comments there to see if anyone has had any update, and doesn't look like it yet. But maybe next week, hopefully, if we hear more, we'll keep you listeners informed, because it is a bit annoying. As I said, I don't know how bad the audio fault is, because I haven't got around to watching mine yet. And from what I understand is it's if you're watching it on a standard telly, it's noticeable, but not that bad. But if you're listening on surround sound, apparently it's really bad. But also, I think what most people are saying is you may not think it's that bad until it goes on to episode two. And apparently you can really notice the difference between the two episodes. I think that's what people are saying. It's really noticeable if you're watching both parts together, because they sound totally different sort of thing. So, yeah, a bit annoying, because it's such a lovely looking set, and it's really nice to have this Tom's first season on, you know, all together in one box. And I wish they'd just blimmin' check these things. Like, it can't be that difficult. Don't they have any like quality control or anything?
Well,
you know, it's just frustrating, isn't it?
Do you know what, mate? This is not uncommon with DVD and Blu-ray box sets, you know. Because I know of a few problems with other franchises and their box sets. So the Star Wars saga, remember when they first brought that out on Blu-ray? And the box set, the artwork was like this nice sort of oil painting of Tatooine with a little Anakin on the front. Is that sandy looking?
You know that box set? I've got it.
Yeah, me too. There's two faults on two separate discs on there. And also, there's a Star Trek box set. You know, the original Star Trek, you know, the Kirk years.
Yes, you know, what I like.
Yeah, so when they brought out the Blu-ray special edition remastered sets or whatever on Blu-ray, I think there's about half a dozen episodes where the color grading or the color timing is completely wrong. So on the original broadcast, things like background sets, which were like a blue colored wall, whatever, you know, they were now sort of a bright green. And, you know, some of the uniforms were the wrong color in certain episodes. So it's not uncommon, mate. It's just, but the biggest one for me, because anyone that I've spoke to at conventions about anything other than Doctor Who, you'd know that I'm a really big X-Files fan. And a couple of years ago, they brought out this mega box set, which I pre-ordered. It was...
Oh, I remember, yeah.
Yeah, they remastered the entire, like, 11 seasons or something onto Blu-ray, and it looks absolutely fantastic. But pretty much all of season 8, there was this problem where all of the episodes looked like the brightness was turned all the way down.
Oh.
So literally every episode, it looked like you were, you know, somebody had turned the lights out in every scene.
Yeah.
But that seems, you know, there's, like you said, what's, where's the quality control?
How
do you not pick that
checked
up? Yeah. But those guys were really good. I can't remember who I spoke to. It was like somebody in their office in London. It was like, I can't even remember who did it. 20th Century Fox or Paramount or somebody like that.
Yeah.
And there was an email like this one with the BBC. And within, I think it was about 10 days, I got through the post a whole stack of replacement discs, the fixed ones.
Yeah, so that's cool.
Yeah, so that was all good. So hopefully the B will do that. They'll first of all acknowledge the fault because they haven't done that yet.
And
then they'll send out replacement discs. So fingers crossed. But if you need to, anyone else that's suffering with that problem, and we don't exactly know, we're 99% sure that it's affected all of them. But yeah, we heard somewhere along the line that they delayed it because they were fixing it. But
that's what makes me think, is it all of them?
Yeah.
Because I thought that's why it was delayed. I mean, it just makes me wonder if they just thought, well, that batch is just get rid of that, you know, send that lot out. It's already done and we'll fix the future releases. But either way, it's a bit shoddy. But yeah, I mean, back in the days of the good old BBC shop, when they had the same issue with the Day of the Doctor DVD, you know, you had to send them your disc and they'll send you one back. And, you know, I know why they do that, so that people don't just send in for a free disc. But it is annoying because you've got to have your case with a disc missing in it for however many weeks until they send it to you. And it does annoy me that we have to go through all that. Yeah. But it's one of them things. It can't, you know, I suppose we can't be helped, but it is a frustrating. Talking to the X-Files, and it comes back to what you were just talking about. I see they added David Duchovny, whatever his name is.
Duchovny, yeah.
Your mate. Yeah, Duchovny. David Duchovny. And I thought, to LFCC this is. And I thought, God, Gary will be pleased. And you were.
I were.
So you saw the price.
And I saw the price again, yeah. I think he's...
I immediately messaged you saying, Gary, look, he's been added to London Film and Comic Con. And you were like, yes! And then you went, oh, no. He's like, what is he? He's 85.
85 quid,
he's up there at Eccleston, isn't he?
I mean,
I suppose he's quite a big US,
yeah, he's a big one, I suppose. And they tend to do this at LFCC, don't they? Where they'll line up guests sort of literally weeks before the event.
Yeah.
You know, these sort of big US Hollywood stars, I suppose. Yeah, I was really excited because outside of Doctor Who, you know, The X-Files is probably my favourite sort of sci-fi TV thing, I suppose.
Yeah.
So I was really excited, but I don't know. It's weighing up the cost of, you know, getting a photo or something.
Are you tempted?
Yeah. It's weighing up it's weighing up getting somebody big, you know, as a one-off, and then not having anybody else, or getting sort of, you know, three or four other people who would add up to the same. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, I know what you mean.
But anyway, the Blu-ray box set, DVD inquiry line at bbc.com is the email address you need. Other than that, it's a beautiful set, as we've said a few times now. It's to have it in hand as well. And just the design is not the actual visual, but, you know, the little Velcro thing that folds out and then you've got the little booklet inside there. It's a beautiful set. Really nice.
It is. Yeah, you open it. It's like the TARDIS TARDIS that you open up, and then inside you've got the console and a lovely booklet. And it's a beautiful thing to own. It really is. Yeah.
Anyways, I guess we should We're quite light on news, but shall we do it?
Shall we land it?
Shall we land it? No, the only bit of news that we have is somebody's been has been very naughty.
A very naughty boy.
There's lots of tuts going on. Tut, 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 tut. Mm. Yeah, a person has been very naughty. So I think when was this put out, this leak? Was it in the last week or last 2 weeks?
It was last, I think it started 2 weeks ago, but yeah, it sort of all kicked off last week, didn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, so you may have seen on the interwebs and on socials that a link was knocking around, or several links that sent you off to this page where you could view a leaked scene, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
A leaked scene or some clips from Jodie's upcoming first episode from series 11. And you and I had a conversation about this, didn't we? It's really annoying for... I think on last week's show, you said that somebody was badgering you with a link and you were just like, oh, go on in, just show me the bloody thing. And then, you know, it didn't turn out to be that, you know,
I switched
spoilery.
It off. I actually didn't watch it. Yeah.
Yeah. And before we go on, you know, the leaks thing, and if you're into that, then, you know, knock yourself out. You know, if you're really into seeing, if you don't want to be surprised and, you know, entertained when the episode actually goes live, then, you know, knock yourself out.
Mm-hmm.
But we just don't do that on this podcast, right? We don't do
exactly.
The whole rumors and leaks and all that stuff, because 9 times out of 10, it's fruitless anyway. Because, you know, these things, I mean, this is obviously a leak that's, you know, a proper clip from the upcoming episode. But everything else, like rumors and hearsay and everything, normally it's just some deranged fan, you know, at their laptop as usual, just going completely mental on a forum somewhere.
Yeah.
Somebody then picks up on that and puts that on Twitter. Somebody else sees it, and before you know it, it's an official thing.
Yeah.
You know, Doctor Who, you know, the TARDIS is now a bright green. And everyone's like, is it a bright green? I don't think so. Somebody must have said that, but who said it? I don't know. Did the BBC say it? We don't know. Well, this is half true.
It's half true.
And then before you know it, it's like a fire, it spreads, and then you're in trouble. So we appreciate, you know, the quite a few people that have sent us links to this leak and all the rest of it, but thanks but no thanks. So that's our view on it. But anyway, this leak, the BBC have treated it very seriously.
Very. So chibbers.
Normally one of two things will happen when leaks get out. The first thing is the channel or the studio that's making it will just ignore it and deny it, and they'll just say, oh, I don't know what you're talking about, you know, whatever. The other direction is they will come out with their own very speedily, hastily released proper, you know, trailer or something, because they want to be officially out there first. They don't want the leak to be out there for too long. They want to try and officially do something, which I think is what the BBC have done a couple of times before over the last couple of series, haven't they? There was the whole thing with John Sim coming back, and because they didn't want the leak to be the source of the surprise, if you like, they then took it upon themselves to do the official, you know, John Sim's coming back, because they wanted to be the ones to tell people and not be leaked. In this case, the BBC have taken legal matters. So they've gone to court basically to try and obtain the details of the individual or individuals responsible for putting the clip out there.
Quite serious, isn't it?
So the clip went online somewhere, I'm assuming YouTube, first of all.
I don't know where it was.
And the BBC BBC Worldwide, they took it down fairly hastily. And then, and this is all in the US, by the way. This is not in the UK. So the BBC has now requested that the federal court issue a subpoena to a company called Tapper Talk. And Tapper Talk is the You know, whenever you visit an online forum on a website, on a computer, TapperTalk is basically an app where it sort of condenses that down into a mobile-friendly version of a forum kind of thing. But they're based in the US. So the what you can do in the US, I'm sure there's like a UK equivalent, but you can issue something called a subpoena where that gives you access into the company's records to track a person or persons to see when something was put live or whatever.
Yeah.
And by doing that, they can obviously get to the source of the leak. They can identify the username, whoever put that leak up first, the clip, you know, the clip. And yeah, so the BBC are very unhappy because the leaks that have been out previously that we've discussed, they actually did something about that. So back, way back when it was brought back in 2005, apparently there was a bunch of clips from the first episode, Rose, that went out.
I vaguely remember that, actually, yeah.
Yeah, and they found out who was responsible for that leak and they just fired him immediately, you know.
I think it's a good thing, mate. I really do. I got into a bit of a Twitter argument about this last night when it was come up as a piece of news on the BBC website, you know, as being tweeted out. And, you know, I'm like you. If a fan wants spoilers, then, like you said, knock yourself out. But what I started arguing about last night with people was that this sense of entitlement from some fans that think, you know, it's okay for somebody to steal someone's property and put it out there. And people were having a go at me saying, well, it's their own fault because, you know, they've kept everything so secret. You know, whoever got that clip wanted to share it so that it's like an achievement. Huh? And I was like, yeah, but you're missing the point. It's a stolen piece of property. I know it's great for you if you want spoilers, but it's someone else's hard work. And I said, what you got to do is put yourself in, turn the situation around. So, right. So some of the people that were really laying into me on Twitter last night, you know, some of them do like these fanned films on YouTube where they use their Doctor Who figures to do stop motion. And you know what I mean? They make these little films. I said, imagine you've spent, you know, a month or so working on a little scene and you've almost got it ready and you're thinking, oh, I can't wait to get this out on my YouTube channel. But somebody comes in while you're asleep, takes that file off your computer and puts it out, and you wake up the next day and it's all over Twitter. So it's a bit of an exaggerated example, but you get what I mean, right? Yeah, worked on that. You've worked on that piece of film, and someone's just come and taken it and put it out there. You've got no control over it, and you're thinking, that's mine, right? But that wouldn't be all right. So why is it okay if it's the other way around?
Exactly.
It's not, you know? And it's another example would be, imagine you, Gary, you went and you got some great pictures of Tom Baker at that convention. And you're like, I'm really pleased with these. I'm going to put these out on Twitter. Look, Tom Baker, hang on, someone's already got them. But that's my photo. But someone's plastered them all over the internet. If you've worked on something or you've got something and it's your property and someone comes in and takes it and then does what they want with it, whatever that might be, that's not right. So, and I was getting quite heated with people last night. I mean, as I said, I don't care if you want to enjoy spoilers, then fine. But don't tell me it's right, because it's not. It's still someone's property that's been taken.
Yeah.
You know, and I was getting quite heated about that last night. You know, this sort of sense of entitlement that some fans have got that, well, we haven't had anything, so why shouldn't we get a Leeds clip? No. You know, that's not how it works.
It doesn't work like that, no.
You know, so I'm afraid I got on my high horse a little bit last night. And I was trying to not, I hate arguing with fans. I really, you know, I hate, you know, we're all part of the same community, but I was just couldn't get my point across to them that, you know, I don't care if you see the spoiler. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, like, have respect for the people that have made it and spent time and don't want it out there yet. You know, it's a respect thing, you know.
It is, mate. And it's unfortunately, it seems to be a portion of fandom you absolutely nailed it, where there seems to be a portion of fandom that seem that they feel like they're entitled.
They feel like they own the program.
Yeah. And it's not just Doctor Who. I mean, I speak to a lot of people within the Star Wars fandom community. And Star Wars is just as bad, if not worse, because it's that same feeling of entitlement. And I don't want to go too far off track, but with The Last Jedi, that's really divided fandom in Star Wars.
Yeah.
And you have a bunch of people who say, I didn't like it for this reason, and that's fine. But then you have another group of fans, and they say, well, I don't like it because they didn't make the film that I wanted them to make.
Exactly.
And it's like, it doesn't work. It's the same with Doctor Who, you know. It's, you know, regardless of how you feel about the BBC and how Chris Chibnall runs things now, you know, because we've mentioned a few times that everything's on lockdown and they're being very secretive with clips and even even simple things like promotional pictures. They've only ever released, was it two?
Yeah. I mean, it is frustrating. I get that. I said to you the other day, God, it's like the Capaldi thing all over again, that same pose. It does. I know it's annoying, but it, as I said, it's just... It's just the way it is.
Yeah, and that exactly. And if that's the way that Chibnall wants to run things and the BBC want to do things, then that's the way they do things. It's not up to us as fans to demand that the BBC release things now. You know, we're not... I just can't conceive of a thought process within certain fans' heads that makes them feel like because they watch a program, they have some kind of ownership of it. It's like, yes, sorry, go on.
No, I guess, ownership of it. But fair enough. I mean, fair enough if you're like, you know, you're really excited to go out, but it's ownership of something that actually isn't supposed to be there. It's not supposed to be released. You know, it's like if there was a trailer that had been released in the US and we just couldn't get it over here, it's blocked from YouTube. Fair enough. Kick up a stink. Come on with the, you know, with the UK fans. Where's our trailer? You know, that's okay. It's out there. But not something that is an unfinished clip that is still being worked on that isn't supposed to be seen, and to say that, well, I've got every right to see it because they're being so secretive. No, you haven't. And as I said, the only way I can get my point across is just reverse the roles. Just put yourself in the position that was your property that someone had taken and blasted across the web, you know, and then tell me that you feel the same, because I don't think you would.
No,
you know, and I think this is why I'm glad that they're doing, because a lot of people on Twitter last night were saying it's a complete overreaction and it's just a TV show and the BBC are going over the top and hasn't done anyone any harm, it wasn't that spoilery, all these excuses. But I don't agree with any of that. I think it's good they're doing it, because I think it might make the next person think twice.
Yeah, absolutely.
They might think, oh, blimey, I know, I'm not risking. Oh, no. Yeah. I don't think, you know, because I think, I just hope it hammers home the message that you just can't take someone's work and do what you want with it.
No, it's good old-fashioned sort of piracy, I suppose.
It is.
You know, it's, you know, and there's a massive conversation around there, but essentially, you know, it's... You're knowingly putting something out there that's A, not yours, like you said, and B, is not an official release of any kind. So,
yeah,
it sucks, really.
I mean, I'll get off my soapbox now, because I don't want to go on and on, but that's how I feel. And I think, you know, I think Chris Chibnall, we all heard that he was going to be very tight on keeping spoilers off the internet, and he really is. It does seem he's really trying to do that. So, you know, and that's the way he wants to do it. So I personally respect that. You know, it might not be my personal taste, for example. I might want some spoilers. I don't, but let's say I do. But I respect that that's what Chris Chibnall wants.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. And it's only a good thing, because we were drip-fed so many things in the run-up to Series 10. We Series 8, 9, and 10. We were given so much in the run-up to those series that we pretty much knew everything that was
coming.
You know?
Yeah, we could pretty much put the story together by the photos released, yeah.
Yeah, so it's nice to be... It's going to be really cool to sit down and watch Series 11, Jodie's first episode, and be like, you know, surprised and, you know, and sit there and think, you know, this is all new and fresh. You know, in a certain way, I don't want to have everything given to me beforehand. I want to be surprised and wowed and all that.
And I wouldn't be surprised if most of the fans that are moaning about the fact we got too much spoilers from last year are the same fans that are moaning we haven't got enough from this year. You know.
I know, mate. I know.
So anyway, so sorry to go on, but that's, it just did annoy me a little bit. But I think this is good. I'm glad they're going to these lengths, and I hope they find them and make an example of them.
Yes. Yeah. So we'll let you guys know how that goes. If
And when you see me and Gary being hurled into a police cart next week because it was us, you're, no, as if we would.
Yeah, this is the biggest cover-up you've seen.
Yeah.
But yeah, so in a nutshell, BBC are in the US are applying for a subpoena to try and find out who was responsible and
give them a jolly good smack bottom.
Punish accordingly. So that's all we've got for news.
Yeah.
We got one bit of merch though, so let's bring in our metal friend and see what he's got.
Okay.
Merch corner. Merch corner. Merch corner.
I don't know whether to be impressed or disgusted.
It's a bit rubbish, but it's pretty. It's very pretty.
Talking of the 13th Doctor, Jodie, she's going to be getting her very own comic book run, which is going to start in, well, this, the comic that we're going to discuss now is out in September. And it's one of those issue zero comics where if you've ever bought a run of comics before or you subscribe to comics, normally when they release a brand new run of something, they will sometimes do this issue or volume zero where it's like a precursor to the main story that's going to start with volume one or issue one, which is quite cool. And the Titan are doing this with the upcoming 13th Doctor comic run. Titled The Many Lives of Doctor Who. And it's a special, like we said, a volume zero edition. And it will essentially go through all of the previous incarnations in a kind of intertwined multi-doctor story that will lead up to volume one and Jodie's character taking over. So we have a bit of blurb on this. So it doesn't say an exact date. It just says released in September 2018. The 13th Doctor Volume Zero features a stellar cast of comic creators, including Richard Dinick, Mariano Lacalustre, Giorgio Sposito, Andrea Florin, and Brian Williamson. I think a couple of these people are at Comic-Con this year.
Oh, cool.
In the Comics Alley. And Rachel Stott. So all of these people that have been working on Doctor Who for Titan have put this new 13th Doctor series together. It's a 64-page edition. It comes with two covers, so you and I will probably get both.
Buy both,
bloody
yeah.
Covers. It's got, and the covers are different artists. So Claudia Laniello,
mm-hmm.
Is one variant, and which is like a typical sort of comic book styly cover. And the other one is by Will Brooks, who's done a ton of the.
He's done loads,
Titan
yeah.
covers. And his one's really cool. It's like more of a photographic style, but it features like the little ruby stone volcanic type of rocks that were in the reveal.
Oh, yes.
You know, the logo reveal.
I hadn't twigged us what it is. Yeah, of course it is. Yeah, lovely. Yeah.
And hidden away very subtly in those little red rocks are the faces of some of the other Doctors.
Oh.
So David Tennant's in there, Tom Baker, Paul McGann. Colin Baker.
That is gorgeous. I've only just noticed that. Yeah.
Really cool cover. So there's two variant covers and it leads up to volume one. Now this is interesting because you may have seen on some covers for some other books that have been out that they're doing that Star Wars thing. So in the run up to The Force Awakens, they had a bunch of stories and it said The Road to The Force Awakens. So they're doing the same thing with Doctor Who. You may have seen some other books or comics, and at the top it says The Road to the 13th Doctor or something like that. So interestingly enough, volume one will be released in October. The launch issue is in October. And so that's quite interesting because we've been debating for a while now when Series 11 is actually going to be on our screens.
Yeah.
So for Titan 2, because this is meant to go in sort of parallel with the TV show, this 13th Doctor story. It's not meant to be out before the TV show starts. So volume zero, September, which is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And then volume one, which is the proper start of the new comics run for Jodie's character, is sometime in October. So can we safely assume that Series 11 is going to be broadcast in October?
It sounds like it, doesn't it? Mm. It sounds like it, yeah. I'm loving these screen grabs from the sample pages of the comic. The artwork is fantastic.
Awesome, isn't it? Yeah.
There's a Seventh Doctor page. If you want to see this, just go to DoctorWhoNews.net. They've got a couple of pages from the comic, sample pages. It looks really good. Mm. I actually can't wait to get this.
It looks really good. Yeah. Mm. And there's another page, sample page as well with Hartnell. And it just looks really
Is that Ian and Barbara?
Ian and Barbara, yeah. We're a fan of the Titan comics, aren't we?
I love them, yeah.
And this will obviously be a bit of a change in direction because so far Titan have always focused on... I know they've done a Baker issue before and a Pertwee and stuff, but the majority of their stories have been the current Doctors since 2005.
Mm.
And so I think this is going to be another little change in direction for them. So obviously Jodie's a very different Doctor and everything's, different. So I think this will be really cool.
Yes, I do too, mate. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting this. I love the covers. I particularly like that Will Brooks one. That's awesome. Really cool. Yeah.
So volume zero. Look out for it. September.
Indeed.
That's news and merch.
Done.
Right. Review time.
Indeed.
Seventh Doctor.
Review. Ice World.
What are we doing this week, buddy?
I can't roll my ass for that. It's Dragonfire.
What, do you want to go here? The Lake of Oblivion?
Where?
Death of Eternal Darkness? Ah. Dragonfire? I should stop at home if I were you, Doctor.
Oh, this sounds brill.
My sentiments precisely. What's your name, incidentally?
Everyone calls me Ace.
Oh, how do you do? I'm the Doctor, and this is my friend, Mel.
And we're really going to go looking for dragons?
Too risky, if you ask me.
Nonsense, Glitz. Time for a quick adventure, then back for tea.
Ace, that's the spirit, Doctor.
Hang about. You can't go without me. That's my map. And I don't want these girls coming along either.
What?
It's too dangerous.
Professor?
And since it's my map...
Right. You male chauvinist bilge bag. Just you wait.
Oh, nice.
Ace doesn't have anywhere to go.
Nonsense, an idyllic place, Paravel. It's got lush green fields and a village blacksmith.
Doctor, she comes from the 20th century.
Oh.
Come on, Mel, extract your digit.
I'll send you a postcard.
But I don't have an address.
Oh, I'll put it in a bottle and throw it into space. It'll reach you in time.
Ace, where do you think you're going?
Paravel.
Ah, yes, but by which route? The direct route with Glitz or the scenic route? Well, do you fancy a quick trip round the 12 galaxies and then back to Perivale in time for tea?
Ace!
But there are three rules. One, I'm in charge.
Whatever you say, Professor.
Two, I'm not the Professor, I'm the Doctor.
Whatever you want.
And the third? Well, I'll think up the third by the time we get back to Perivale.
Aww.
Aww.
What a lovely moment, eh?
It is. It is. A little tear in the eye.
Goodbye, Mel.
Yeah, see you, Mel.
So, Dragonfire. It was first broadcast back in November to December in 1987. It was written by Ian Briggs, directed by Chris Clough, overseen by Andrew Cartmell. And it's the Seventh Doctor, so Sylvester McCoy, with both... Mel and Ace, Bonnie Langford and Sophie Aldred. The story kicks off with the Doctor and Mel arrive at some spaceport on Ice World, appropriately named. It's a world made of ice, so Ice World. And they meet up with their old pal Glitz, and it turns out he's been up to his old shady dealings again. He's landed himself in a bit of trouble, but he did manage to find this treasure map in one of his card games, and apparently it leads down into the lower levels, the caves in Ice World, where there are several sort of nice, wondrous places, apparently, but also something, this treasure, which turns out to be this kind of energy source within the alien or the dragon's head, whichever you want to call it. Alongside this, the actual base that they're on is this, turns out to be this huge spaceship that was put there. So the baddie of the story, he was exiled from his home planet and put onto this ice world. And in the meantime, he's been sort of collecting, he's like frozen people to use as his like drones, his soldiers and so on. While all the while trying to figure out where this energy source is and so on, so that he can repower his ship, go back to his home world and seek revenge on his jailers and people that exiled him. But it turns out that in the 3,000 years that he's been there, 2,000 years before that, his planet was destroyed by the sun collapsing anyway.
Yeah.
So he tops himself and then the Doctor goes off with Ace after saying goodbye to Mel.
Mm-hmm.
So roughly, that's it.
Yep.
So the last story of series 24 and the 150th story of Who, is this a fitting one? Is this a decent one for you, buddy? A little three-parter?
Well, I think it's good that it is three parts. I think if it had been four, I think it would have suffered badly. It's not one of my favourite McCoys, I'm afraid. I find it watchable. There are certain bits in it I really like. I think the last 5 minutes are fantastic. It's a beautiful little end scene. But leading up to that, it's very hit and miss for me, this story. I mean, I love the McCoy era. I think all our listeners know that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an odd one, this, because tonally it's all over the place. It's quite a sinister story. I think the actual storyline's pretty good. It's quite sinister, isn't it? The actual story itself, and there are some quite sort of severe moments in it. But then in between all that, there's some really comical, sometimes quite over the top comedic stuff going on, and it doesn't always gel. But I think the biggest thing that lets it down is sadly the production side of it. You know, it doesn't look particularly good, this episode. It hasn't dated particularly well. and also, surprisingly, you know, the direction really doesn't help it, because Chris Clough, good director, but I don't know, he says this himself on the making of, he obviously just sort of took his eye off the ball at certain moments. So the dreadful cliffhanger to episode one, where the Doctor is literally hanging off a cliff for no apparent reason, is something that should have been sorted out. Again, it comes down, I'm almost certain, to that old enemy time. They were probably really rushed when they were filming it, probably didn't think anything of it, just did what was on the page. And then when they're editing it together, they suddenly think, well, hang on, we didn't really sort. Because I think what's supposed to have happened is the Doctor's supposed to have realized that he can't get any further on that ledge. It's sort of a dead end. So the only option is to go down the cliff to the next ledge. I think that's what's supposed to be going on.
So,
but that does not translate on screen at all. I'm not putting it totally at Chris Clough's feet, because I'm sure there's lots of reasons for the fact it doesn't translate on screen. But moments like that just let the story down massively. But it's watchable. I don't dislike it by any means. And there are some great positives to this story, which I shall enjoy talking about as we go through the review. So it's a bit hit and miss, but perfectly watchable, I think, is my overall view on it. But yeah, it's okay. It's just not it's never going to be one of my favorite McCoys, but there are bits about it that I really, really like. So yeah. What about you, mate?
Yeah. I don't mind it.
No,
I don't mind it. It's okay. It's an interesting series for Doctor Who, series 24.
It is. Yeah.
Because, it's McCoy's first, and there are only four stories in this series. So, and it's McCoy's first one. And it's a bit of it's like the warm up for me before we get to see McCoy at his best.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah,
because there was a bit of sort of a transition happening at Doctor Who at the time, because Time and the Rani was McCoy's first story, and before that there was a bit of bad blood, wasn't there? Because Colin Baker had been thrown out, pretty much. They'd picked him up by his scruff and, you know, out the door. He sort of landed on the doors and exploded onto them and rolled out into the alleyway. And, you know, there's some cat sort of licking his finger as he's laying unconscious in the alleyway. So he was treated really badly.
He
really was. And then it was a case of, well, what's going on with Doctor Who? You know, and instead of just cancelling it, because the director of the show whatever his name was. I can't remember the guys. I should remember. I can never remember his name. Who hated Doctor Who, one of the BBC directors.
Michael Grade,
that's it. You know, you would have thought that him and whoever else was in charge would have just, if they were that unhappy about it, you know, just cancel it. But, you know, John Nathan Turner was, you know, had some big ideas apparently. And so they let it run, and then McCoy comes on board, and there's kind of this up in the air feeling, because you have the previous Doctor, Colin Baker, which, let's be realistic here, wasn't everybody's favourite Doctor.
No.
You know, BBC people and fans alike.
Mm.
So you've got this thing where it's like, what are we doing with the Doctor? You know, who is he? What's going on? So you've got Andrew Cartmell, who obviously comes on board at the same time as McCoy, and they're like, so... And with that, and this is when we interviewed Andrew Cartmell. If you guys want to know some more sort of in-depth details about what we're talking about, go onto our website and search for our interview with Andrew Cartmell. It goes into a lot of this stuff. But essentially, Cartmell had a plan in his head for what he wanted the show to be and what he wanted the Doctor as a character to be.
Mm.
And it's referred to as the Cartmell plan, isn't it?
The master plan.
Cartmell master plan, yeah. And McCoy also had his feelings on his Doctor as well. He wanted to bring back that darker side and that more mysterious, because he is an alien at the end of the day, and he wanted to bring back that, you know, if he's an alien, let's treat him as an alien. He's meant to, we're not meant to know everything about him, and he's not meant to be so human all the time. So let's have that more manipulative, darker side alongside this mysterious stuff. But the thing is with Series 24 is they don't quite get that in motion just yet. Because it feels like a lot of the production people, and, you know, they were kind of like, well, let's just play it safe for this first one. Let's not make too many big changes to the Doctor's character. And so because of the sort of person that McCoy is and his previous acting jobs, they went down this more sort of comedic, lighthearted, almost kind of Butlins stage show kind of feel with a lot of the stories. I think the only one that we don't really see that as much is potentially Paradise Towers, because that has quite an art, you know, a dark undertone and a quite sinister story. So that's quite dark. But I mean, if I can't even remember which episode it was, but when you and I reviewed Delta and the Bannerman, there was one bit where you and I just fall about laughing for about 15 minutes altogether.
I think there's a few bits in that, but yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's the same, it's got the same feeling with this one and for most of Series 24. With the exception of a few bits in Paradise Towers, where, you know, we're not seeing McCoy at his best yet. And that's why somebody asked me when we was at the Genesis screening, it's like, you know, what can I do to get into McCoy? You know, what is it that made you turn it? Because I've got a checkered history with McCoy.
Yeah, because I was going to say, I bet if you were watching this when you weren't into McCoy, because it took you a while, I can imagine you watching this just thinking, oh, this is awful.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, I can imagine you not digging this story at all to begin with.
Absolutely, mate. Yeah, I would have been like, crikey, I just can't do this. But
yeah.
And yeah, I said, I think it was our new friend, Phil, that we met.
Paul.
Paul, sorry. Yeah. I think it was him. He said, you know, I'm having the same thing. I just can't get into McCoy and I can't get into it. So I remember saying to him, look, you've just got to persevere. But one thing I will say is don't go in with Series 24, because that's kind of McCoy and Cartmell trying to do something new and fresh, but they haven't really got
haven't figured it out.
Yeah, the script and the stories are too comical and lighthearted, so it does have that sort of Butlins feel to it, like you're going, you know, to see a stage show or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, kick off with Series 25, you know, go in with the big one, go in with Remembrance at the start of Series 25. And that's how I genuinely feel whenever I watch any of McCoy's Series 24 stories. I feel like, yeah, he's good. And don't get me wrong, I've come a long way. I absolutely love McCoy's era now. He's one of my favourite Doctors. I love it. But I do feel that in Series 24, especially Dragonfire, I feel like they could have had a stronger series close than Dragonfire. We could have possibly seen a little bit more of an inkling of the Doctor's darker side towards, you know, the last part of this story. So it kind of leads you in, because in Remembrance, there is, we do start to see that little side of him, don't we? That darker side coming out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I don't mind it. It's okay. It just doesn't feel like McCoy is doing the business yet.
Yeah, I'm with you. You can see things starting to click into motion in this, can't you? Like with, in terms of the Can't My Mouse plan, like bringing in Ace as the new companion.
Yeah.
I love the fact that they sort of tested out two possible companions, because John Nathan Turner was thinking he might have used Ray from Delta the Bannermen. So he said, let's write these two stories where we, you know, could use either of them. And either Ray or Ace will go on to be the companion, but let's see which works best. And I like that. I think that's really cool. So, you know, all the way through, he's thinking one of these is going to be the new companion. And I mean, considering that Sophie had never, it's a bit reminded me of Bill, Pearl Mackey. Sophie had never been in front of a TV camera before, I think she says on the making of. So the first scene she did was when Kane's offering her the coin, mm-hmm. and she looks terrified. And she said, because she actually looked up and saw her face on all the monitors and was terrified, thinking, oh, this is big, you know. Mm. So I think she's like really good in it. I was quite surprised actually how sort of good her performance was watching this again last night, because I remembered sort of this being quite pantomime, this story. I haven't watched it for ages, Dragonfire. It's not like Remembrance and Greatest Show, where I sort of put it on quite often. It's one of those stories I only watch now and again. So I was just quite surprised at her performance, how sort of good she is in it. She's so feisty, and you can absolutely see why JNT decided she would be, you know, the good choice for the next companion, because there is, you know, her and McCoy go on to be one of my favorite double acts. I think they're brilliant together. So yeah, it's just, you know, tonally and stuff, it's just a bit of a strange one, this. But like you said, you can see sort of certain things starting to click. So you've got the brilliant pairing of the Doctor and Ace coming together at the end. McCoy's actually, he's not there yet, but you can see he's starting to really slip into the Doctor's shoes nicely. That little clip you played, the end bit where he's like, one, I'm the Doctor, you know, where he's going off, he's absolutely superb in that end scene. Mm. And he does this speech, doesn't he, about crazy pavings and his, you know, I wish I could live a life straight on, you know, going through time on a straight path and not all over the place. And he's really starting to click as the Doctor. Like you say, he's not there yet, but he's really getting there, I think, by this point. So absolutely. It's an interesting story. It's as I said, it's all over the place, really. There's quite a good story at the heart of it. Bad production. One of the things I really like in it is Tony Selby as Glitz. I think him and McCoy are really good fun together. In fact, also Glitz and Ace are really funny together as well. The way that she, you know, the stuff that Ace gets out with, like build bag and all this sort of thing. It's, I don't know, that I think is really good fun. It doesn't quite go over the top like some of the other moments in it, but it's a funny one. It's got some great moments. It's sort of leading on to a great next series. But yeah, you kind of feel like they've got all the sort of components there. They've kind of thrown them up in the air, and certain bits have landed and certain bits haven't yet, you know.
Yeah. No, I read you, man. And it's kind of, the story, although it's fairly simplistic, there isn't much of a crossover, because there seems to be two storylines running concurrently. You've got the Doctor and Glitz, who go off to find, you know, the treasure or the dragon fire, whatever it is. And then you've got Ace and Mel, who kind of slip in and out of that story arc.
Yeah.
That episode arc. And then on the other side of the coin, you've got the bad guy, haven't you? Kane, who is trying to get back to his home world. And he's kind of, I wouldn't say imprisoned people, but he's kind of forced people to pledge their allegiance to him, and they serve him, you know, absolutely, kind of thing. Mm. And he's kind of got these army of frozen people as well, because when he freezes people, it sort of wipes their memory, I suppose, is what they're going with. And they seem to run concurrently throughout the three parts and don't really cross over too much. The only time we see them cross over is when the two people are after the Dragonfire. You know, those two people that
those
have got
two
the
guards.
Big bazooka-type weapons, and they're after. And they get mixed up with Melon and Ace, don't they?
Hmm.
And that's about it, really. The two storylines, because normally in Who, in classic Who especially, those storylines sort of intertwine throughout the entire thing.
Yeah.
You know, and people are going, you know, interacting with each other. But it seems not strange, but it would have been nice to have the Doctor interacting a lot more with the bad guy in the story.
Yeah, because he literally only meets him at the end before the bad guy, for want of a better word, has a meltdown. But the Doctor, I don't think he even saves the people that are frozen, does he? Or at least we don't see it on screen. That it doesn't really sort of tie in, and none of that stuff gets tied up, does it?
I don't think so.
It doesn't. No. Well, I mean, I'm sure, like off screen or whatever, we're to assume the Doctor helps him. I don't know, but yeah, kind of like he meets the bad guy, Kane melts, and then we have the little leaving scene at the end. It does. Yeah, the two storylines don't sort of satisfactorily get entwined together. I see what you mean, yeah.
It's weird, isn't it? Because normally, you know, I'm not saying it has to be this way, but normally with Classic Who, you have the Doctor against the monster.
Yeah,
The Doctor or against the villain, yeah. But we don't have any of that, really. It's quite strange. Like you said, the Doctor, they only meet right at the very end of the whole story.
And it's really brief, isn't it?
Very brief, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I found that kind of weird. I would like to have seen more to-in and throw-in. You know, Kane, you know, reinforcing his what he wants to do, his evil plan, even if it's cheesy James Bond villain style thing. And then the Doctor coming back with his quips and his one-liners and his, you know.
Yeah, because there's a lot of wandering around. There's an awful lot of wandering around with the Doctor and Glitz. And then, like you said, and Mel and Ace, yeah, just sort of going through the ice caverns or whatever they're meant to be. But yeah, you're right. They definitely could have built that up, actually. Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, some of these story elements are not too bad, I suppose. I mean, you have the Doctor and Glitz off on a treasure hunt.
Which is quite a fun idea, yeah.
Yeah, that's quite cool. And then you have Mel and Ace, who are kind of stuck together because they've been told, you know, that they're not allowed on the boys only trip.
Yeah.
So they sort of rebel a little bit against that and stuff. And even those guys, there's a lot of running around and wandering
and a bit of screaming.
And a little bit of from Mel, yeah.
What did you think of the cantina scene? Because you got to think of Star Wars, haven't you? And you see stuff like that. So they go in the cantina and it's full of every sort of mask and outfit from the BBC, what would you call it? Stock room.
The prop and animation costume shop. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I spotted one of the aliens is wearing Avon's outfit from Blake 7.
Oh, right. Cool.
I can't remember if he's got an alien head or if it's a human, but somebody definitely had Avon's. It's a black with silver sort of lapels and stuff. So that's Avon's outfit. And then there's this sort of weird fish type alien that seems to keep moving seats between shots. I don't know if you noticed that. He sort of, one minute he sat behind the Doctor, and then suddenly he's over there. I'm pretty sure that it's the same thing. And then there's a funny little dog creature that the Doctor goes up to stroke and it tries to bite him. That's funny.
Did you not think that was really similar to the little dog pet
Fifi
from
Happiness Patrol.
Happiness Patrol. I thought was it the same little. It's very similar, isn't it?
Very similar, yeah. Because we only see it. Well, in fact, we hardly see it on screen at all, do we?
No.
I'm pretty sure that's a McCoy ab lib. I'm sure.
Yeah.
But there's all these sort of strange. They go into like the alien calf, which again, I'm sure on paper sounds fantastic, but again, it's sort of the sort of thing that would get laughed off screen by a non-fan. If you're watching this and someone come in and like, "What are you watching? What the hell is this?" You know, it looks very cheap. I kind of like it though, and I love it when Ace pours the milkshake over the miserable old bar.
Person,
the guy who's sort of bossing her around, because I guess we've all wanted to do that to our boss at some point, or a boss, I should say. So that's quite funny when she sort of she tips it over that silly woman as well, doesn't she? Ace is so feisty in this, I love it.
Yeah.
She tips the milkshake over that woman with the kid as well, doesn't she? For having a go at her.
Yeah, you can absolutely tell that they wanted her to hit the ground running with the
and she does
the very rebellious you know, young and, yeah, just rebellious nature, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah, she launches the milkshake over the complaining woman.
I love that. I suppose because I work in a bar and stuff, I can relate to that. but yeah, I like Casey's of sort of quite a rounded character from the word go. I think in this we totally get her personality straight away, don't we? Which I think I like. I instantly warm towards Ace. You know, she's a little bit of a stroppy teenager in this one, but not in a sort of annoying Rose type way. I think she's a, because there is comparisons, isn't there, between Ace and Rose a lot of time. People said, oh, like Rose was the modern Ace. Well, I can see that to a certain extent, actually. Yeah. But yeah, like all those things. I just thought of you with the canteen. I thought, oh, did they do that in another one? The sort of Star Wars canteen thing. I think they've done a few times, haven't they?
Yeah.
Did it in a Matt Smith one, didn't they, where they had like the fish purse in the background and all that. And,
yeah. They also did it at the end of Time Part 2, where Tennant goes to see Captain Jack.
That's it. That's the one I was trying to think of.
It's another.
Alonzo. Yes, that's the one I was trying to think of.
This one doesn't look amazing, but you can see what they were trying to...
You can see where they were going with it.
Okay, so in terms of story then, fairly simplistic. Runs along fairly smooth. I wouldn't say it's the fastest paced classic Who story. I wouldn't say it's the slowest. It's kind of moves along.
It does plod a bit. I mean, as I said, I wasn't bored, but I also wasn't like really engaged with it either. It does kind of just plod along because it's, what's the writer's name? Ian Briggs. He wrote Curse of Fenric in the next series. And that is, or is it the last series? Which is just one of the, you know, is such a good story. And that feels so different from this story in lots of ways, if you know what I mean. So, which is a good thing because it shows he's quite a versatile writer. But yeah, I knew he'd written something else and I was trying to think what it was. And I was quite surprised when I read it was Curse of Fenric because they feel very different, I think.
Yeah. Mm. I read you. It's, it does plod a little bit. It doesn't move too quick.
A little ploddy. Yeah.
And I just think, I mean, in terms of, we'll get onto the cliffhangers in a second, but in terms of sort of beginning to end, I mean, it starts off reasonably well. It does feel a little bit Star Wars-y in some places.
Mm.
You know, you've got Glitz, who's this kind of rogue card gambler. He's like the Han Solo, you know, the story.
Yeah.
Doesn't quite have the look, the dashing looks of Harrison
Han
Ford.
Han Solo in the later life, the later years.
Yeah, but you've got the Doctor who's on the journey sort of thing and he's hanging out and then you've got, you know, Glitz, like the Han Solo character. And you got the bad guy, Kane, and stuff. It does feel, you know, a little bit Star Wars-y in terms of its themes.
Yeah.
And the conclusion's okay.
I do think it would suffer if it didn't have Glitz in it. I mean, he really brings something else to the story.
Yeah.
It makes it a lot more fun to watch. I mean, if he wasn't in it and they were just plodding around those ice caverns and, you know, running away from things, you know, he does bring something to this story, which I think it desperately needs.
Yes.
So, because he's actually from, it's only his second appearance, isn't it? So he was in the Colin Baker story, which the name escapes me because I never really watch any of Colin's stuff, if I'm honest. But he was with someone else in that, who I think was called Dibber. I can't remember. I'm going completely off my, you know, from memory. I think the other character was Dibber, who obviously is not in this one, and we can only assume that Glitz has lost him in some deal. but I think he totally works. I can believe that he's ended up where he is on this planet, you know, in loads of debt and stuff. It's absolutely where I can imagine the character ended up. So it's nice that they've brought him back, you know, into the show. And I think he does work really well in this story. He certainly brings a lot of fun to it. I'm just going to see if I'm right, if it was Dibber. I'm sure it was Glitz and Dibber. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, so I think he must have been in one of the Trial of a Time Lord stories.
It is, it's a Mysterious Planet.
That's it, there Mysterious Planet, And it would be a less entertaining story without him, because he does bring
definitely.
A bit of comedy now and then. He's one of those likeable characters, isn't he, where he's not... You can tell that his motives are not positive. You know, all he's interested in is money and making money and scamming people. And he's one of those type of people. But he's very likable because at his heart, you can tell that he's kind of got a soft spot for the Doctor. He's,
Yeah.
You know, he likes the Doctor and he helps him out a few times in this one, like the cliffhanger scene. And so he is kind of, he does bring a certain element of entertainment to the story.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I think Tony Selby is a great, great choice for the character. He's absolutely spot on as that sort of likable, but you know he's a bit of a rogue, yeah,
yes.
sort of character.
Mm. Yeah. And I guess he does owe the Doctor a bit of a favour, because he asks the Time Lords, you know, they take it easy on him at the end of that story, if you remember.
Oh, yes. You know, yeah.
So he does kind of owe the Doctor a bit of a favour, I suppose.
Mm. We haven't done Trial of a Time Lord yet. We're still not sure what to do with it, but God.
Yeah, we have no idea how we're going to do that. No. But yes, and then just to finish off story and stuff, I like the, it's not really a twist, but I like the fact that the dragon is actually the monster that is jailing Kane, if you like. He's there, you know, as like his jailer, if you like. And the power source that Kane needs is the whatever you call it inside the dragon's head, which is the dragon fire itself, I suppose. I like that kind of twist that, you know, this dragon supposedly haunts the lower levels of the ice world is actually there to make sure that Kane doesn't escape, because Kane needs that to get his ship powered up, and without it, he can't do anything. So.
I think that's a great little idea. It's a good concept. That. What do you think of the design of the dragon as well? Because considering that the show, this particular story, doesn't look that great in terms of the production, it does look like they've run out of money, probably because it's the end of the season. But I think the dragon design for the time actually is pretty nice, actually. I quite like it, especially when its head opens up and it's got the crystal in it. And, considering how the rest of the show looks, I think the dragon itself is quite nicely designed, actually. I mean, clearly it's a person in a suit, but we've seen a lot worse. You know, I think he looks quite good, actually. What did you think? Do you like the look of the dragon, or did you laugh when he... Because it is one of those things, I think, you know, when he walks in on screen, you know, some people now would probably laugh off screen saying, oh, what's that? But I thought he looked quite cool.
I think when you first see it, that very first scene where he's just there,
you know,
the big dragon head and the lasers come out of its eyes, whatever. I think then when I first watched it, I was like, you know.
What's that? You know,
but then when you see, like, from the back and the overall design and everything, I think it does, for its time, I think it's pretty cool. I mean, it's very clumsy. The actor inside it couldn't run at all.
Very clumsy, yeah.
And the head, even though it was made of probably, I don't know, polystyrene, something very light, it was still very clunky and wobbles a lot. And you can't move very quick at all. But I think the design down the costume's back, it felt like
spine.
The alien from...
I was just going to say it's very alien-like. The film alien. The spine, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, the film alien, yeah.
Yeah, so you can tell it's used like sort of other sci-fi as an inspiration, which is good because, you know, good sci-fi borrows from other good sci-fi, so...
It's exactly. Good.
Yeah,
I think I made a note that it looks good when it's not shown fully, because I think this is a common problem with Doctor Who. When he comes out into the bright light, the costume really shows. But I think when he's kept in the darker parts of the sort of set, I think he looks good. I think, but it's just unfortunately, it comes out into the big bright ice cavern, and it's like, oh dear. Yeah. But yeah, not too bad for the time, I thought.
Hmm.
Yeah,
not too bad. Okay, let's talk about some characters. So a decent supporting cast in terms of numbers in this one. We'll come on to Kane and Glitz in a moment, but we do have... So the opening scene did feature a chap, and I'm sure I've seen him before. He was the one that...
Oh, yes.
Yes, he was... So Glitz, this is what we don't get... to find out until sort of halfway through the story. But when Glitz landed on the ice world, he essentially sold all of his crew off to Kane for them to be like slaves, basically.
I think that's what happened to Dibber, yeah.
Yeah, so he essentially sells all of his crew. But we don't find out until later. But the opening scene, you see his crew being lined up ready to be sort of frozen. But there's one chap that sort of rebels and fights back and escapes for a little while. And he was really good. And I can't for the life of me remember his name, but I've seen him in some other things. I'm certain of it.
It sounds like you mean, the actor's name is Tony Usoba. He was also in Destiny of the Daleks, I think. Is he a villain? Yeah. Am I remembering that right? Let me have a quick look.
I think so, yeah.
Or am I getting confused?
No, he was in Destiny. He was. Yeah.
He was?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Yes, of course, that's it. Yes, he was a villain. So, yeah, I thought the same thing. I was like, oh, it's him. I know him. Hmm. Yeah. And he is quite good in it, isn't he? He's a sort of character they could have sort of used more, really.
Hmm. I thought he was really good.
Yeah.
Oh, no, we're thinking of the wrong chap. We're thinking of the wrong chap.
Are we?
Yeah.
Which chap are you doing?
So Tony Usoba was the guy, one of Kane's lieutenants.
Yeah, that's who I was talking about. Who did you mean?
Oh, no, don't get wrong. He is good. He is good. But yeah. I was thinking of one of the slaves that sort of accidentally puts his hand near the liquid nitrogen.
Oh, that's the guy from London's Burning.
And he screams back. And yeah, I thought he was really good.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't over impressed with him. What is his name? I've got to find. I'm sure he's the London Burning guy because I was like, oh, I know him.
It probably is him. Now that you've mentioned London's Burning,
I've got to find him. Got to find him. Yeah. Here we go. Sean Blowers is the actor's name.
Ah, right.
Is he London Burning? Am I remembering right? Yes.
Yes, you're probably right.
That's him.
That's him. Yeah. Yeah. His character name was Zed.
Yeah, he's only in the beginning bit, isn't he?
Yeah, but do you know what? I thought he kicked the story off really well because he's the first person you see, really. He's the first one that gets it and kicks off, really. So I thought he was quite good.
Actually, I will say, while you're talking about the start of the story, I thought, because, you know, when I put this on last night, as I said, not watched it in ages, when it started, I thought first few minutes are pretty good. I was thinking, actually, maybe this is better than I remember because of that beginning. It starts off really well, I think, quite sinister. You're sort of drawn into what's going on then with these guys getting frozen. And then, yeah, Zed kicks off and does he get killed? I think he does, doesn't he? He gets his face frozen or whatever. So it's quite a good start, actually. I'm quite sinister and Kane's really evil straight from the get-go. So, yeah, I agree. He does kick it off quite well. I just thought his acting was a little bit... He's going for it. He's a bit OTT, I thought. But, yeah, it kicks it off quite well, I agree.
Yeah. And then we have the little girl that was...
Oh, yeah.
So she was in it at the beginning where Ace launches the milkshake over her mum. Mm-hmm. And you don't think anything of it. But then she kind of... She's like a plot device towards the end of the story because she's wandering around on her own because her mum, you know, she's been separated from her mum. She doesn't seem too bothered. She's just got a teddy bear or whatever, and she's walking around. And then she's the very last face you see. So as the TARDIS dematerializes, she gives like a little chuckle, a little laugh, and then that's the end of the story. But child actors, renowned for being pretty bad in Who. No exception here, really.
No. I'm going to say that's a bit time filler, isn't it? Because, suddenly towards the end, she's like hiding under a table. And then there's a scene where she's sort of hiding from the guards under the stairs. And it does feel like they just needed to fill a few minutes. So, because there's no point to it at all.
No.
But it's quite a nice scene when she looks at the TARDIS and she's about to go in, isn't she? When her mum says, oi, there you are. And it sort of drags her off. She's literally about to sort of push the TARDIS door open. Mm-hmm. And then she's dragged off and then she just turns back and sees the TARDIS leave. So it's quite a nice little moment. But like you said, yeah, not the best acting. I'll tell you what I did notice, actually. It was with the TARDIS landing. They don't often do this, I don't think. Somebody might want to correct me. But when it lands with people moving. Because I think it's that woman and her kid, isn't it? Are looking in a freezer.
Yes.
So they've mixed a moving sort of shot with the TARDIS landing, which works really well, actually. It makes it feel really... Because normally you get like a static shot of, say, like a field, and then they mix the TARDIS landing in it. But there's no one in the background moving around, you know. So I thought that's quite nice. They've tried to do something a bit different there. Hmm. I can't remember if they do it when it takes off or if we just get...
I think... No, you're right. It's
next to a couple of people moving.
It looks really good, though. I can't remember of another time that they've done that. But
yeah, they've probably done it, but I just struck me that they don't do it very often.
Not in classic Who, anyway.
Mm. Oh, yeah, exactly.
It's
normally,
because I think they do it quite often in newer Doctor Who. But
well, presumably it's harder to mix if you've got because normally you'd lock the, you know, you'd lock the camera so it's exactly in the same position.
Yeah.
So if you've got people moving around in one of those locked off cameras, it probably makes it harder to do. So, yeah, I just thought it was a nice little touch to it.
Yeah, it's a nice, because they, the TARDIS lands right by a conveniently this wall, don't they? So
yeah,
and the edge of the wall is perfectly down the middle of the screen. So you, that's like that's a nice cut-off point to sort of have the two images sort of mashed up together.
Yeah.
But no, it looks pretty cool. Let's talk about, I mean, there's a few other people. So let's talk about, I can't pronounce his character's name, but Tony Asoba. What's his character's name? Cracia.
I don't know, Cracia. Actually. I honestly remember them saying it on screen, but yeah, I'm sure they do. But yeah.
He was very cool, very authoritative.
I liked him.
Yeah. That opening scene, like, just really cool and collected. You know, he's sort of giving everyone their, you know, their orders, really not having any messing around. And then when Zed does sort of kick off, he's not having any of it. And then when Zed escapes through the door, he's just like, ah, don't worry about it. You know, he's in the forbidden zone. You know, he won't last for much longer.
So yeah, that's it.
He had like sort of typical bad guy vibes, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but I thought he was quite good because he's got the bad guy vibes, but he's not too over the top sort of with it. I think he should have been developed more because we get to see more of, how do you say her name? Belez? the woman. The ginger-haired woman that's also part of Kane's crew.
Belaz, I think her name is.
Belaz. Played by Patricia Quinn, because she gets a lot more screen time. But I have to be honest, she's not as good. I think she's actually a bit too over the top because she's trying to be really feisty and evil. But I would have liked to see a bit more of Tony Asoba's character, really. Or maybe the two of them together. But
yeah.
I think they missed a trick there, really. She's okay. I mean, she's better when she's trying to sort of double-cross Kane. And then there's quite a nasty scene, actually, where he suddenly grabs her head and shoves it on the console. And that's, I thought, cool, that's a bit harsh.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's such a light-hearted sort of story, you know, and then suddenly you've got moments like that where Kane's really violent and you're like, oh, and there's the bit where they sort of cut off the dragon's head. I remember, like, as a kid being like, oh, no, they've cut the dragon's head off. Mm. And then obviously there's the famous melting of Kane's face at the end.
That's a bit strong, isn't it?
As we've mentioned that, should we talk about that for a second? Because that is, for the time and for a, what is considered at the time by the BBC as a children's program, it is almost as graphic as the Indiana Jones, where they did exactly the same thing. I mean, in the one in Indiana Jones, they put red into the wax to make it look like blood, which apparently they purposely avoided in this. But it's still a fantastic effect. Mm. But basically what they've done is they've created the actor's head, made a wax mold of it, which looks really good. And then they've melted it on screen because he opens up the sun visor. And so it's pretty grim for what has been quite a comedic, fairly sort of pantomime-ish episode. And you suddenly get this horrific effect of Kane melting. I remember being absolutely shocked as a kid when I saw that. I wasn't disgusted by it, but I remember sort of thinking, God, they're going to get complaints for that. I remember just being like really surprised by it. But I think even today, though, it looks brilliant, but it's pretty gross.
Yeah.
Like the whole eyeball falls out. It's, you know.
Yeah, it sort of comes out of nowhere as well. It's really unexpected because when he raises the UV filter or the sun filter or whatever, you kind of think you'd get this subtle effect of, you'd hear a scream and then the camera would flick back.
Just white out or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you'd see like a little pile of, you know, sand that's meant to sort of, you know, insinuate that he's been, you know, turned to dust sort of thing. That's what you would expect to see in a kid's program or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's out of nowhere. So he stands and, because he commits suicide essentially, doesn't he? He knows that his time's up. There's nothing for him to live for. His home planet's gone. You know, that's it. So he runs over to the window and then, yeah, it's this out of nowhere, this really graphic. It is wax, isn't it? I'm pretty sure it's a wax model.
I think it's a wax. Model.
And they've melted it, and then they've done like this time-lapse speeded up kind of effect where it happens quite quickly in front of your eyes. And yeah, I remember the first time I watched it, I was like, I actually said out loud, I was like, whoa.
Mm.
My wife came in, she's like, what's going on? I'm like, you'd not believe what I've just seen on this episode of Doctor Who. At the end, and she was like, what was it? So I showed her, and she was like, okay, that's pretty strong for a, because, you know, she's aware that it was a kids program, you know.
Yeah. And it is out of nowhere.
Yeah. I was like, whoa. But yeah, it's very strong.
Yeah. And I don't know, I'm sure they did get like, it was brought up on the equivalent of Points of View back then, whatever it was called. Yeah. But yeah, so it did get complaints, but I'm not surprised. And I am surprised they show it so full on. Like I would have thought, you know, when they were watching it, they might have thought at the time, oh, we better just show a little bit of that, not the whole face melting, you know. So, yeah. But I think it's fantastic. I'm glad it was left in, but it surprises me to this day, actually, that they had the guts to get away with it, mm-hmm. you know, that they thought it was acceptable. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Getting back onto characters. So Tony Sober. Was in Destiny of the Daleks.
It was, yes. I thought it was him, yeah.
And then he pops up in the newer series with Capaldi.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And he was hardly in it.
Yeah, he plays a character called Duke in Kill the Moon. He was only in it for a couple of minutes.
Is it Kill the Moon, is it? Oh, Kill the Moon.
But he's only there for a couple of minutes, small part. But
that's right.
I thought he was fairly decent in this.
Yeah, I did, yeah. Yeah.
What about... so we had the two of Kane's... soldiers, if you want to call them that, who go off with the motion trackers and the bazookas to find the dragon.
Mm. Are they the ones that chop his head off?
Yeah, they cut his head off. I thought they were quite plain, really.
Yeah.
Not
in fact,
impressed.
I can't even remember what they looked like. Yeah. I really can't even remember. You know, that's literally the only bit I can sort of picture is them when they're sort of lancing the poor old dragon's head off. But yeah, I can't, they were forgettable, I suppose.
Very forgettable, yeah. They get zapped by the dragon fire energy, don't they? And
that's it.
Yeah. Mm. Let's talk about, so we've spoken about Glitz. Before we get onto him, let's talk about Kane, the bad guy then.
Oh, yes.
Edward Peel.
Mm.
Solid performance from him. He's into it the whole time, isn't he?
Yeah, he is, yeah. And I think he's, because he's got very sharp features, I think he makes for a good villain because he looks quite sinister. He really suits the role. I do have to crack up, though, when he's having this ice sculpture made of, presumably it's his like love of his life that's, I don't know what's happened to her. And he's like, it's almost as if she's in the room with me again. And it's absolutely blimmin' awful. It's a terrible sculpture that looks really, really cheap. So I had to laugh at that. But I mean, yeah, he's, like you said, even in scenes like that where he's, I mean, if it had been me, I'd have been really struggling to keep a straight face. He's, you know, he's giving a good performance. I think he's great as Kane. I know he wasn't first choice. It was they wanted somebody else. Can't remember who it was now. But I think it's good they got him. I think he absolutely suits the part down to the ground, actually.
Yeah,
he's who was it they wanted? Yeah,
they wanted someone else, didn't they? And change his character a little bit.
Ronald Lacey they wanted, but I don't know who he is. I don't know if I'd...
Yeah, I don't know.
He's actually the... What? They want, you know, the guy that's in Raiders of the Lost Ark who actually melts.
Oh, him.
They wanted him.
Oh.
Well, that would have been strange.
He'd
have been like, I'm not being melted again. He's already been melted once.
Yeah.
Yeah,
once
that's
melted,
bizarre.
Twice shy.
Yeah, that's a bit bizarre, isn't it? But anyway, no, I think Edward Peel's pretty cool.
Yeah.
As the, I've just realised I didn't mean that as a... Pretty cool. I said that totally intentionally, but no, he's good.
Yeah. Glitz, then. We've spoken about him already. Tony Selby.
Very good. Yeah, I love Tony Selby.
Very
he
cool.
He pops up in Minder a lot. You know, I love Minder.
Minder,
and he's great in that as well, yeah.
Yeah, so a pretty cool character. I think you were right earlier that it would have been a much more mundane
view
and experience, yeah.
It would have really plodded without the nice little scenes of him and Ace and the Doctor and stuff. Yeah, definitely.
Mm. What about Ace and Mel then? Those two together. They spend a lot of the time together in this one.
They do. Yeah, I like them together, actually. I do feel a bit sorry for Bonnie Langford as Mel, because she does feel like, it feels all the way through this as if like she's just there to leave at the end. She really doesn't get much to do apart from scream at the dragon, and and it's almost, it's so on cue, that bit as well, isn't it? It's like, it's so unnatural the way the dragon appears and she's like, ah, screaming her head off. Yeah, I feel a bit sorry for her, but there are some nice scenes between her and Ace. You really get to see the contrast of the two characters, because Mel's a very gentle sort of personality, where Ace is quite feisty and she's like, I ain't got a mum, I ain't got a dad. You know, she's really in Mel's face at one point, yeah. And Mel's like, all right. So there's a real nice contrast between the two, and I think they work really well together, those two. But Ace just stands out so much over Mel, and it's down to the writing and the character that she is, I think. So Mel for me sadly gets lost a bit in the background of this story, I think. You know, she just seems to be there, but not really doing anything. Whereas Ace is right in there throwing Nitro 9 at anything that moves.
Yeah, you can absolutely see the, because I think what we mentioned earlier about both Andrew Cartmell and McCoy wanting to take the Doctor in a darker direction and do that darker stuff, it wouldn't have suited Mel.
It wouldn't,
at
no.
all, would it? Because if you look at Mel's character, she's very kids' TV. You know, she's very bouncy and happy and, you know, she's got that positive, happy children's vibe about her. And I think, you know, it just doesn't, it wouldn't have suited her character at all, because it would have had to have been such a massive turnaround of her personality. It just would have felt forced. And so you can see why they've brought somebody like Sophie Eldred in as the new companion, because moving forward in series 25 onwards, it does get darker and it needs more action focused, rebellious, darker tones, doesn't it? So,
yeah, she's much more streetwise Ace. So I think kids would have much more related and taken to Ace. Because like you said, Mel, bless her, she's just too nice and smiley and, you know, and she screams and that's about it for her. And that's nothing to do with Bonnie's performance, because I really like Bonnie Langford, but it's the way the character is written, you know, it's just, you know, Ace is the stronger character. I do think I absolutely love that end scene where Mel leaves. I think it's a beautiful, beautifully written scene. I believe Andrew Cartmell actually wrote it, didn't he?
I think so. Yeah,
I think because although this is written by Ian Briggs, I think Cartmell wrote the leaving scene with all that beautiful dialogue about time and everything. It does come out of nowhere, though. Like, it's literally like, right, the story's over. Time for me to go, Doctor. There's no sort of, it's not like Tegan, is it? Where she's seen all this death and destruction and she's like, I've had enough, Doctor. I've just had enough of the death. So you can sort of see why Tegan left. But Mel, she just decides I'm off. And I although I love that end scene, I don't really get why she would go with Glitz. Like, the Doctor could just take her back in the TARDIS. I know that sometimes the TARDIS, he can control it and sometimes he can't, whatever, but he could just take her home. I don't know why she goes off traveling with Glitz, because I don't see much chemistry between the two of them, really. Do you know what I mean? I don't quite buy into that. But I do think it's a beautiful end scene nonetheless. You know, I really like it and I love all the stuff, all the dialogue between the three of them at that end bit. It's probably, it really brings the episode up for me. I love that scene so much. Mm-hmm. I just literally just adore those last few minutes because of McCoy, because of the writing. I think it's a great send off. I really do. It just comes a bit out of nowhere. That's all.
Yeah. No, I read you. It does a little bit. It's a bit, it doesn't, it's not the best ending for a companion, because it doesn't, like Mel just suddenly deciding, oh, I'm going off.
But she wouldn't go with Glitz, I don't think. Yeah. That's the only thing. It doesn't make sense, really. But
well, you know, there is something about Glitz. And I'll tell you what, if anybody's ever read, have you heard of a story called Happy Endings?
I don't think so.
It was a Doctor Who novel. It's written by Paul Cornell.
All right.
And there's a subject about Glitz that was meant to be in this story, but they canned it because it was a bit sort of risque.
Yeah.
And essentially, him and Ace are meant to have
No.
Do the the dance with no clothes on.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
But she's meant to be like 16. No, she's, yeah, she's meant to be 16. Isn't she? Oh, no,
Exactly.
Naughty.
Yeah. And, yeah, and there's another, in that story, Happy Endings. Paul Cornell actually refers to that incident in the story.
Right.
Because Ace does the do with somebody else in that story.
Oh.
So
I'm seeing Ace in a whole new light now.
Well, this is it. And so there is something about Glitz. I think that the ladies.
It's the beard.
It must be the cool beard.
That I said me and you should do. The cool beard. I don't know. I don't know about that, but I do like the thought of Mel keeping him in check.
Yes.
I mean, I'm surprised Big Finish haven't picked up on that spin-off, actually, because I do like the thought of him, like, you know, getting a slat riff off Mel every time he tried to do anything bad. So that's quite fun. But, yeah, I don't mind it's rushed because it's just I love the fact that we're bringing Ace in. You know, I can put any sort of things like that aside about the fact it doesn't really make sense to me. I don't care because it's just great the way they bring Ace in, I think.
Yeah. No, I agree. Mm. Very cool. Mm-hmm. And lastly then, McCoy himself, I think we've spoken about him already enough as we need to. He's a great performance, you know.
I think it's worth mentioning how good he is in that last scene.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I really, because I was watching that and just thinking, he's so the Doctor, you know, when he's like, number one. Number two, he's absolutely into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those sort of pratfalls that we got in Time of the Rani 3 stories before, you know, that's all gone. He's got the costume, he's got the scarf, he's got the umbrella by now. He's, you know, I think he's getting there. He's really sort of ready to go.
Yes.
And he's now got this new companion. So he may not be quite there yet, but I actually think he's pretty good in this story.
Yeah, I think his performance is really good. Mm. But like we've said a few times now, he's just not quite there. With his what he wants to achieve with the character, but especially that last scene, really, really good.
Oh, he's awesome. Brilliant in that. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything you want to mention before we wrap this up for our scores?
No, not really. I think we covered it, mate.
One thing I will say is that this isn't a terrible story among fans, because when Doctor Who was coming up to its 40th anniversary, I assume it was the BBC, actually. They were doing a poll for each Doctor, and you could vote on which story you wanted to see rebroadcast for that 40th anniversary.
Oh, right.
And Dragonfire was the story that was voted for by the majority of McCoy fans.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Which is very interesting, because you would immediately assume Remembrance or Survival or something, you know?
Yeah, that is surprising.
Mm. Oh, there we go.
Hmm.
Another bit of trivia before we wrap up. You don't get to see the TARDIS interior now until The Greatest Show in the Galaxy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Gosh, not like the Colin era then, when they spent nearly the whole entire series in it. that's interesting, yeah, because I there's something about McCoy in that TARDIS set that just really suits him. I love him in that TARDIS set. And then I think, which story is this? Is it Battlefield, where they realised they'd thrown the walls away? And so they have to just put some round plates on the wall and turn the lights down. And so Great Show is probably the last time we get to see that set, I guess.
Yeah, because Battlefield's after that, isn't it?
So, oh, what a shame.
Yeah. So, yeah, there we go. Let's move on to scores. Let's wrap this up. So I think it's you to go first.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give it a 6 out of 10.
Okay.
A 6 out of 10. Yeah, it's watchable, nice, decent, but just doesn't quite hit all the marks. So, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to give it a 6.5.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, pretty much the same reason as you. It's okay. It's not too bad. It's a fairly good watch. It's just not McCoy at his best yet, or the show at his best. But
Show at his best, yeah.
Yeah. What did our listeners think? Let's kick off with our audio review that we had in from Sammy Satine.
G'day, Gary and Adam. Sammy Satine here. So, Dragonfire. I like this story. Kane, the evil frozen one, is interesting. I always enjoy seeing Ace. I also don't mind Mel. The dragon is interesting. Also, the literal cliffhanger at the end of part one is both a good cliffhanger and funny. I give it about 8 dragons out of 10. See ya.
Eight dragons.
Eight dragons. Well, that's quite high.
Yeah, that's fairly decent. Mm-hmm. We did our normal Twitter poll, and 76% of you said likey.
Oh.
And a quarter of you, 24%, said stinky.
Oh, right. Not bad, then.
A few comments in on Twitter as well. Jordan Shortman, one of our writers, said, I quite like Dragonfire. Some of it may look pretty cheap, and there's that whole cliffhanger with the Doctor climbing off the ledge for no good reason. But the story has never really bothered me. It's a fun little round runaround that introduces Ace, one of the best companions. Mm-hmm. Rick Moran says, the introduction of Ace, thankfully, she stopped jumping around and actually saying Ace after the story. That got annoying quickly. The best part was Kane melting.
Yes, it's good.
Yes. Heisenberg Jr. says, the concept is great, but needed a few more redrafts to iron out the quest. Not to mention they should have scrapped the sets and start over. They look dreadful.
Mm-hmm. But it's nice. They're not great.
Yeah, he says it's nice to have Glitz back, though.
Yeah.
TARDIS Files HQ says, if only this had a little more money to be spent on it. Good concept and ideas, and McCoy is great as always, but it just ended, just needed a little more cash. But of course, how can you forget that literal cliffhanger? And the explanation to it was cut, ? Yes, it was. Mm. It gives it a 6.5. Andrew Cuthbert Jr. says, the best things being the departure of Mel, the introduction of Ace, and the best cliffhanger in television history. Why do the sets look like the back of a Farm Foods, though? Where are the frozen peas? Very good, Andrew. Very good. John Winston Scott says, one last truly dreadful story in a terrible mess of a series redeemed only by the creepy darkness of Paradise Towers. Fortunately, the next year saw a massive improvement in quality. The Gallifreyan Whovian, our friend Morgan, says, it's a fun episode, not the best way to introduce a new companion, but it's okay. Why Glitz only but not Dibber returned is beyond me, and it's a nice departure for Mel. Kane's melting face is one of the best effects of all time. A very precise 5.7.
Dibber has been sold.
Sold off, mate.
He's gone.
Ronning Troy says, great way to find Ace, and Glitz was a good character. I think it's a great one to watch on a hot summer day. Lots of ice. Very good. And truly loathed the bad guy, Kane, but a nice goodbye for Mel.
Yeah.
Nick Payne says, terrible story.
Oh, dear.
Weak supporting characters, awful first episode cliffhanger. What annoyed me the most were the scenes in episode 3. Of this little girl going around the ice world doing nothing interesting or plot related apart from scenes with the dragon. He goes on to say, I'm also not a fan of Ace's character in this story.
Really? I thought she was good in it.
Yeah, he says, don't worry. I do find her to be one of the best companions of all time, except here. Thankfully, Remembrance fixes that, and Ace is now the Ace we know and love. Another reason why Remembrance is the best classic. Over on Facebook, we had a few messages there. Jeff Waddle says, a simple plot, perhaps too simple. Add the mystery of Ace to it, and it's all a bit of a mixed bag. Mel going off with Glitz doesn't ring true. But on the other hand, the melting baddie is a wonderful special effect. Nobody mentioned the cliffhanger. 4 out of 10. Dan Pin says, not the best McCoy story, but fun and uncomplicated and easy watch. Sophie hits the ground running as Ace, and the seeds of one of the best TARDIS teams are sown. Nice to see Glitz back, although I don't buy him and Mel heading off together. But I really like the farewell scene. 6 out of 10. Miles McKenzie, I have no idea what to say about this one. I neither liked or disliked it. It's a bit random for me, although I liked the smooth transition of companions. 5 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
Dooley Johnson, I found this one to be kind of fun. It gets odd towards the end, especially with that hilarious cliffhanger. But overall, it's all right. Nothing too unbearable. Ace has a great introduction and Mel has a good exit. 6.5. Dean Jones says, not the strongest McCoy, but decent enough. McCoy is great. Sophie makes a strong debut. Glitz back is fun. Kane is decent. And despite the noticeable budget, the production is okay, even if the body of the creature looks like the Xenomorph from the Alien series.
No, that's it, yeah.
He gives it a 7 out of 10. And lastly, Jason Thayer says, I remember being so happy when Mel left. I no longer had to put up with her constant screaming. Gives it a 7 out of 10.
Gosh, she can scream as well.
Anything on the Geek's Handbag page?
Yeah, he did. So Andrew Moore says, it's a terrible story. However, he finds it interesting that the woman is wearing Avon's costume in the cafe. And he sent me a brilliant screen grab, actually, which I've just seen. I'm going to cut these down a bit because people had quite a lot to say. But if you want to read them in full, please head over to my Facebook page because people had some good stuff to say. Bradley Willard said it's a guilty pleasure. He thinks the practical effects, such as Kane's death at the end of part three, are done superbly and love Tony Selby's glitz. He gives it 7 out of 10. Charlie Turner says it's a bit too cheesy for his liking. It used to be in his top five McCoy stories, but not anymore. Oh, he gives it a 6.5 out of 10. Patrick Sherwood says he loves it. He says he thinks it's a good watch. The Seventh Doctor is great and Ace is amazing. And she's his favourite, so he's giving it a 9.5 out of 10. Kevin Mullen, this for me is when Sylvester became the Doctor, he says.
Okay.
Sylvester is excellent in this. Bonnie doesn't great. The supporting cast are fine. And only Sophie is a little bit annoying, but that's hardly surprising considering it's her first time on TV. There are some wonderful scenes, such as the Doctor confrontation with the guard, who totally defies stereotyping, and Kane's death is very well done. He gives it a 6.5 out of 10. Callum MacArthur just simply says he loves this one. And finally, Zach Jenkins says, Ace is amazing. Mel is Mel. The ending is creepy. 7 out of 10.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fairly consistent scores there. I think it's averaging around a 6-ish, 6.5.
Yeah, I reckon, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much, guys, for sending in your clips and reviews and et cetera, et cetera. Next week, we're back to Torchwood.
Yeah.
What we got next week, buddy?
Next week, we will be reviewing Cyberwoman, which is the next story in Series 1. Cyberwoman, yeah.
Interesting one.
I think that's going to be, yeah, I think we're going to get some interesting comments on that one from what I've heard.
Yes. I think we get to see a bit more insight into Yanto that we haven't seen thus far.
Ah, right. Well, that'd be good.
Yeah. So Torchwood, Cyberwoman, next week. And I think we're going to wrap there, dude, for 194.
Okay.
Thank you so much for sticking with us and listening to this, what looks like it's going to be a 2-hour job.
Yeah, lots to say.
194. We ranted a little bit earlier, but I think it's needed sometimes. Definitely needed. You know, if things with the whole spoilers and leaks, just be mindful. That's all we ask.
Be considerate.
That's all we ask.
Nothing. I'm just updating the schedule, mate. We've only got one McCoy left to do now.
Oh, no.
I know. Just one left. We've reviewed all the others.
Oh, you're joking.
Oh, sad.
Was it Fenric?
Fenric is the only one we've yet to do.
Yeah. Oh, dear. On that note, now that Adam's ended it on a bummer, he said, we've only got one more. Anyway.
Let's review them all again.
Let's do them all again, yeah.
Let's go round again.
In the meantime, why don't you head over to our website, www.bigblueboxpodcast.co.uk. You can listen to all of our previous stories there. Plus, you can link off to all of the socials. And we chat loads of Who and general rubbish throughout the week in between episodes. So give us a like and a follow on those. Also, subscribe to the show on any podcast network that you listen to, whether it's iTunes or similar. We're on there. Just give us a sub, so that you never miss the show when it goes out every Friday. And if you're an iTunes listener, if you could spare a minute for a review, that would be awesome, because that really helps us a lot. Also, check out Adam's channel on YouTube, The Geek's Handbag. Adam's got a very, very cool YouTube channel covering loads of sci-fi stuff, unboxings, reviews, vlogs, the whole lot, the whole shebang.
Yes.
Is in there. So give Adam a subscribe over there. You're also on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram and all that.
I do love me Insta.
Your Insta, yeah.
Yeah, I'm into Insta.
Adam's Facebook is very cool. Every now and then he tinkles the old ivories. Gives us a little live stream of him playing some piano.
On the Joanna.
Yeah. So yeah, give Adam some love on YouTube and the socials. Until next week for 195, my name's Gary.
My name's Adam.
And remember... And...